For Northern England, sorry, that last bit was. For Northern Ireland, a cloudy start with some drizzle, slowly brightening from the afternoon, rather similar to Northern England, in fact, with some late sunshine, highs of 10 to 12. And finally, on to Scotland. Some potent showers in the northwest first thing, cloud and drizzly rain further south, but much, much clearer come the afternoon, a lot of late sunshine. And for Scotland, your highs 10 to 12.
Lovely. Susan Powell there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now on Radio 4, Dejan Sujic, director of the Design Museum in London, reads another extract from his new book, B is for Bauhaus.
The publisher said write a dictionary, but then they told me no one buys dictionaries. B is for Bauhaus explores the modern world through its objects. Today, I'm talking about G is for Grand Theft Auto, a game I can't play, Habitat, and why IKEA fills our living rooms with curiously named furniture. G is for Grand Theft Auto. A new generation of what we still call video games allows enthusiasts to wallow in blood-spattered gore, but they're also a way for those with gentler interests to listen to music, to communicate, to explore the texture of the city. And in their complex modelling of space, architecture, and urban form, they require of their creators both the literary and dramatic imagination of a scriptwriter and also the spatial perspective of an architect. They are also a powerful way to explore what design has become in the ethereal digital world that has supplanted material design. Never previously having laid a finger on a PlayStation console or an Xbox, I was walked through Grand Theft Auto 4 by an infinitely patient member of the Rockstar Games team that designed it. As an adolescent, I did have a brief, though intense, interest in model railways, which was enough for me to recognise in GTA 4 the most elaborate train set in the world. The affluent, middle-aged men, who are now Rockstar Games' most numerous customers, are some of the same people who a generation or two ago might have spent days on end in their sheds, surrounded by intricate spaghetti coils of 00-gauge track, trying to run their own railways, moving them to timetables that attempted to match the real world. The digital version involves hours with a 60-inch flat screen plugged to an Xbox, pursuing the same kind of pleasures, but with the added attraction that you get to kill people. GTA creates a world far more complex than even the most elaborate of train sets. It is, of course, still a world programmed to run on predetermined tracks, but with so many possible alternative routes that it gives the illusion of a system with free will. The Manhattan, portrayed in Grand Theft Auto, goes by the name of Liberty City. You experience it from a helicopter, a car, on foot, and in the subway, or any combination of them. Liberty City may lack a third physical dimension, but it has sound and light and an astonishing level of realism. It works in accelerated 24-hour cycles, so the city goes from day to night and back again, with digitally controlled traffic adjusting itself to rush hours and quiet periods. Players can marvel at the views and at the architecture. They can go shopping, cruise around in a car, listening to the live radio station of their choice. And of course they can splatter policemen and FBI agents, professional assassins and innocent bystanders with a range of impressively detailed weapons, from rocket launchers to AK-47s. Grand Theft Auto 4 sold 3.6 million copies in the first week after its launch in 2009. Given that Rockstar's first iteration of Grand Theft Auto in 1998 sold just 150,000 copies, it's clear that something dramatic had happened to gaming. What made Grand Theft Auto 3 and 4 stand out was that they really lived up to the claim that the video game was a new cultural form, somewhere between the 19th century novel and the spaghetti western. It can certainly be described as a designed artifact, one which invites its users to explore urban and architectural space with a new perspective. Early cinema goers were terrified by the experience of watching an express train coming straight towards them. Grand Theft Auto's players are well aware that they are in no danger from the helicopter gunships that chase them around Liberty City, but they play for the immersive experience they get, one which takes them much deeper into the picture plane than the conventional cinema can achieve. The achievements of Grand Theft were technical, visual, and literary. What made it possible were two British brothers, Dan and Phil Hauser. The explosion of the video gaming industry reflects many aspects of the early days of Hollywood. It has produced its own share of moral panics to match anything that introduced censorship to the film industry. There have been complaints about nudity, sex, and violence. Like the novel and the feature film, gaming needed its own visual and narrative techniques. Rockstar was responsible for creating them. In Dan Hauser, gaming may have found its Wilkie Collins, if not its Charles Dickens. He is a master of a new cultural form, one which has not yet fully evolved and stabilized. Just as the novel required new literary techniques to analyze the life of the mind and the internal monologue, Rockstar played a big part in the evolution from the early era of arcade games, which revolved around zapping relentless ranks of ever more menacing aliens, into an open game that created a cityscape or a western landscape which allowed the player to roam at will. It was a landscape that could be experienced from multiple perspectives. Like the novel, which no sooner had it emerged, also demanded the emergence of a new form of literary criticism, so writing about gaming has moved from the early enthusiasm of the fanzine to more traditional forms of cultural criticism. The New York Times described Grand Theft Auto 4 as a thoroughly complete work of social satire disguised as fun, violent, intelligent, profane, endearing, obnoxious, and sly. But for an insight into what it really represents, you need to look to more specialist critics. There has been a fascinating discussion of the way in which players interact with the characters in GTA. The premise of the game is that the better shape you're in physically and the better your armor, the better your chances of survival. But you also do better if you are part of a loyal posse. That means regularly socializing with your gang members. So the game has a friends management system. If you don't respond to their text messages, they lose interest and your vulnerability increases. The other level of discussion is on the aesthetic and spatial level. One gaming critic wrote, "A bank heist moves from bank to vault to street to subway and back into the street, shooting cops all the way, without a single pause in the action of a single screen. Everything unfolds in the impressively continuous city, without a single seam showing." He sounds remarkably like a film critic, talking us through a Kubrick or a Hitchcock. It's also how a new generation of architects will approach the process of navigating and designing space. H is for habitat. If habitat was once the Elizabeth David of the domestic world, established by Terence Conran to rescue the British middle classes from anaglypta wall finishes and electric fires that did their unimpressive best to impersonate burning logs, Ingvar Kamprad's IKEA is more like Delia Smith. IKEA is cheaper and unavoidable and ready to take shortcuts. Its impact has been all but universal, present everywhere from Northern Europe to China. Its designs are derived from precedents devised by others, yet it has had far more impact on the way that everyday life is lived than the Bauhaus and the Design Council put together. Habitat stood for free-range design. IKEA, with its vast supply of factories that each year turn endless acres of Slovakian and Latvian pine forests into self-assembly chipboard shelves, is the battery chicken of homemaking. Extremely cheap, filling, but not exactly about the subtler flavors, and with worrying implications for the environment. Habitat had wider cultural ambitions than IKEA. What really makes Conran stand out as a designer is his ability to create a way of life that other people want to live too. The twists and turns of his early career are the story of post-war design in Britain. He was at the Dome of Discovery for the Festival of Britain. In the 1950s, he officiated over a stylish espresso machine in his first cafe, the Soup Kitchen, in his striped shirts and 3-inch-wide braces. He opened the first Habitat off the King's Road, just ahead of the Swinging London explosion in the 60s, by which time he had sprouted sideburns. He defined the middle-class living room in the 1970s with his distinctive blend of cantilevered chrome-plated steel Bauhaus armchairs, modular seating units, and whimsical antiques. Conran's objects do not beat you over the head with their personality. Instead, he calls his designs plain, simple, and useful. As designs, they are engaging and touchingly English, the product of a magpie eye and a feeling for making things. Conran's style works because he has a knack of creating a way of life that anybody can buy into. It began as the style of choice for the strapped-for-cash student, the young professional setting up home for the first time, and bit by bit, it almost imperceptibly became the signature style of grown-up Britain, a generational shift that had its apotheosis on the night the Blairs took Bill and Hillary Clinton for dinner at the Pont de la Tour, Conran's Thameside restaurant. IKEA, born in 1943, is still a family-owned business and one that has been far more successful as a business and in its impact on the world than Habitat. It has sales of around £27 billion a year and stores in heading for 50 countries. It is, by any standards, a remarkable company, not least because it has been astonishingly successful doing things entirely its own way. It turned home furnishing from a cottage industry into a multinational production line. It was brilliant at getting its products reduced to the simplest elements that could fill trucks to capacity and sourcing production from the cheapest possible suppliers. And it has proved that consumers from Hong Kong to Russia to Wembley are happy to make their own homes with exactly the same raw materials. IKEA arrived in Britain in the 1990s. It was not just that it made Britain shop for furniture differently, ready to set off for those giant out-of-town blue sheds and come home with a car boot full of flat-pack chipboard and an Allen key. It also changed how British homes look. Despite Habitat's success in the 70s, the vast majority in Britain still took the view that modern design was a piece of chilly good taste that the well-bred attempted to inflict on those less fortunate than themselves. It was associated with hard times and lingering memories of wartime utility furniture designed by the best of Britain's designers to make the most of rationing. IKEA's stuff is not just cheap. It is designed intelligently, and it looks as if it belongs to the real world, rather than suggesting that it is trying to be something that it is not. Its product range is firmly in the modern design camp. It also comes equipped with names that are easy to mock. Most companies, if they had a product range designed with an entirely different audience in mind, especially one named after an unpronounceable selection of Swedes, Finnish vegetables, and Norwegian cities, might consider some sort of modification of how things looked, and even a bit of rebranding. IKEA's strategy was to go on the offensive. Famously, it set out to persuade us to chuck out the chintz and flock to its checkouts to ask, perhaps with a little hesitation at first, for the Jerker desk. Who cares that Mocha is a ridiculous name for a desk lamp? It only costs £2.75. Astonishingly, the strategy worked. Shopping for a new kitchen used to be a once-in-a-lifetime affair. At such prices, it became more like buying a new outfit. Design without the designer price is IKEA's mantra. If you are prepared to spend the day in a giant, city-killing, edge-of-town shed, lining up to wait for your kitchen cabinets to show up, and then negotiate self-assembly instructions that are not for the faint-hearted, then you can equip pretty much an entire flat for the price of one upmarket sofa. And provided that you don't examine how things are made, or worry about how long upholstery that has been stapled into position is going to last, then it will look pretty good. IKEA has done a lot for the way that we live. It has given us cheap, simple kitchens, affordable, comfortable sofas, but it has also played its part in the unravelling of the fabric of our cities and turned shopping for furniture into a pretty exact facsimile of negotiating Terminal 5 at Heathrow on a very bad day.
Dejan Sujic was reading from his new book, B is for Bauhaus. The book is abridged by Polly Coles, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. Thank you. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday, the 17th of April. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North at Cirra, South at Cirra, Forties, Cromarty, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, low Iceland 997, expected southern Norway 994 by 1800 Thursday. New high expected just west of Seoul 1027 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cirra, south at Cirra, Forties, Cromarty. Southerly or southwesterly, veering northwesterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8. Rain, then showers, moderate or poor, becoming good. Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight.